Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday, October 11th. We've got 39 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Also, 37 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Thomas Keyboy. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy Monday, or happy Columbus Day. For those that have the day off today, we're going to be looking at kind of a mixture of a day where the first half, not going to be too bad. Got a little bit of sunshine out there, and the temperature will climb to around 53 degrees. But as we move into the afternoon, the chance for wet weather will start to increase. We talked about this last week where we had one storm system arrive late in the week, and now we have another storm system that's set to arrive later today. So the rain chance will go to 60%. So we'll see the clouds gradually increase as we go through today. Then we'll be looking at a 60% chance for rain as we move from the afternoon into the evening. But then as we go into tonight, it's going to be turning colder and the snow level will start to drop as well. So before 9 o'clock, we'll be looking at a mixture of possibly rain and snow. And then after midnight, we'll be looking at predominantly maybe switching it over to snow, where snow accumulation is kind of less than half an inch. So we're not really looking at too much in the way of any accumulations, but the overnight low tonight dropping to 30 degrees, where the rain chance will go from around 60% up to around 80 to 90%. And then for Tuesday, we're going to be looking at a mixture of rain and snow before noon, and then rain mainly between noon and 3. And then after 3 o'clock, it'll transition back to snow because the daytime high tomorrow will be around 39 degrees. It's also going to be quite breezy with a northwest wind anywhere from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Pretty good chance that we find a good mixture of rain and snow tomorrow with the rain chance around 100%. The rain chance and the snow chance, it's going to start to go down as we go into Tuesday night, but still snow likely. And then looking at the chance for some snow showers just Tuesday night, a little bit more hit or miss as an overnight low drops to 24 degrees. Then on Wednesday, just a slight chance for snow showers. The daytime high, 35 degrees. The chance for snow showers around 20%. And as we go from tomorrow into Tuesday night, again, I'm not really looking at too much in the way of accumulation, still going to be less than an inch if we do see accumulations in Park City. Then we'll have another chance for some snow showers on Thursday with a daytime high of 34 degrees. Then on Thursday night, it's just going to turn cold under a partly cloudy sky with an overnight low of 19 degrees. But then as we go from Friday through the upcoming weekend, temperatures will start to moderate slightly. Still not going to be too warm, but the daytime high on Friday, 41. Friday night, we'll see a low of 23. Then on Saturday and Sunday, we get sunny skies both days with the daytime high on Saturday, 51, 54 on Sunday, and the overnight low on Saturday night, 29. So even though it's October 11th, we'll have a little bit more of a late fall, early winter feel in the days ahead.
Thomas, hey, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Good morning. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Lauren Barrows, co-chair of the Wasatch Back Citizens Climate Lobby, and a new member, Sebastian Nichols, talking about tonight's meeting and also this week's climate solutions debate with the Park City candidates. Park City Board of Realtors CEO Jamie Johnson in with details about an affordable housing event happening tomorrow at the Park City Library Community Room. Then Park City Education Foundation Executive Director Abby McNulty calling with an update on some of the programs being offered by the foundation, also a recap on how things went with the Red Gala event, as well as with the Beat the Call. Stay tuned. First, taking a look at some local news, the Utah Legislature's Redistricting Committee made a stop in Summit County on Friday to gather input from residents as the committee redraws the state's congressional, state legislative, and school board maps. KPCW's Sean Higgins was there and has this report.
Friday night's meeting at Ecker Hill Middle School attracted several dozen citizens curious about Utah's once-a-decade redistricting process. The Legislative Redistricting Committee is made up of 20 members from both houses of the state legislature. The makeup also reflects the partisan split in the legislature with 15 Republicans and 5 Democrats. The committee gave a brief presentation on the redistricting process and the legal boundaries they must respect, but the hearing was primarily for the committee to collect public feedback on how the maps should be drawn. Over a dozen members of the public gave comments on Friday, the majority expressing concern over how the committee could divide the Wasatch Back. Summit County alone contains 3 separate House districts and 2 Senate districts in the Utah legislature. The municipal boundary of Park City is also part of House District 54, which contains all of Wasatch County. Some people see that as unfair to people living in the greater Park City area, while others see an advantage in having a variety of legislators representing the larger community. Summit County resident Suzanne Rosenberg made the case that mixing urban and rural interests could cause more harm than good.
the concept of merging urban with rural areas seems to be counterintuitive to the interests of those communities. As I think we all know, and we've seen in recent elections, that those two areas tend to have very different goals, commitments, and interests. And by trying to merge, as was done in the previous 10 years ago redistricting, it really pits those two communities against each other, and it doesn't really equally represent either one of them.
After several other members of the public also brought up their opposition to districts containing a mix of urban and rural elements, Republican State Senator Kirk Cullimore, who represents South Salt Lake County, clarified that the commission has not taken a stance on what they prefer the districts to look like. However, he did say the commission has heard many public comments in hearings in rural parts of the state that have specifically asked to contain urban segments. The committee is relying heavily on things like city and county boundaries, obvious geographic markers like rivers, major roadways, or mountain ranges, as well as what are called communities of interest to draw the maps. A community of interest could be a group of people who identify along political lines, live in the same area, or send children to the same schools. Bill Goodall lives in Interlaken in the Heber Valley and implored the committee to work with the state's independent commission to finalize the maps. The independent commission was formed after Utah voters approved Proposition 4 in 2018. The legislative committee is not required to adopt any of the commission's suggestions.
What we want to make sure that you avoid is ending up with just the same old map, with the same old voices, for the same old reasons. I believe that you seriously need to listen to them based on the more perspectives that you can bring to the table, the better look you've got at the whole picture. And we desperately need you to do that for the wellness of our state.
Republican State Senator Scott Sandel chairs the committee and represents northwestern Utah in Senate District 17. He said no matter how you look at it, the redistricting process is incredibly complex. Not only are there strict population requirements for each district, but people may also identify with several different communities of interest.
I use the example, is your idea that your most important community of interest where your kids go to school, and what group that is, or is it where you go to church? Is it the city you live in, or is it the county you live in? Or is it in the Uinta Basin, for example, not just the county, but a geographic feature that then makes you a community of interest? So each person will define, and each area will define differently, a community of interest, and also how they rank that in their priority.
The legislative committee will continue a statewide tour of public hearings before meeting with the independent commission early next month to finalize Utah's congressional, legislative, and school board maps. The full legislature is also expected to convene in a special session to approve the maps in late November. More information on the legislative committee and the independent commission can be found on kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
The Wasatch Back chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby is hosting its monthly meeting tonight via Zoom. Also, a climate solutions debate will be held this week with Park City mayoral and city council candidates on Thursday. On the phone with me, I have the co-chair of the Wasatch Back chapter, Lauren Barrows. She's joined by a new member of the lobby, Sebastian Nichols. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Lauren,
good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having us.
Let's start, Lauren, with a kind of a brief preview of tonight's meeting. First, a little bit of a celebration. One of your volunteers, Montana Burek, has been appointed. Tell us about that.
She received one of the two Energy Ambassador Awards given out by Summit County Power Works. And she's really a rock star in our community. She's a sophomore at Park City High School, and she's been volunteering for the Citizens Climate Lobby Wasatch Back for probably a year or so, year or more, and been one of, I'd say, our most active members, adult or teen.
Can you tell us what the award was for?
The award was for being, I think, really active in her community and really helping to make a difference. And I think she's going to get to do some things with them as well.
Okay. Also, it's been a busy month, it sounds like, meeting folks. Let's get an update on the hike that the CCL had earlier this month with Congressman Blake Moore's state director.
Oh, that was fun. Sebastian, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So last month we were able to do a hike in the area with Representative Moore's district director, Travis Campbell, to share why climate is important to Citizens Climate Lobby and some of the solutions that we propose. It was a great opportunity to get to know Travis, Representative Moore's district liaison, and to enjoy the beautiful nature and share why this issue is important to us and some of the solutions that are available to legislators to deal with the issue.
So basically it was like, oh, thank you, and I'll pass your info on to the congressman?
We discussed several specific solutions. Travis Campbell, the district liaison, shared with us that Representative Moore will be part of a group looking at Republican proposals for climate change legislation, preparing for potential opportunities in the future. So we shared the main policy that Citizens Climate Lobby pushes for, a carbon fee and dividend that's revenue neutral. And we're already paying a price for carbon, but this would place a price so that consumers can make the right choices on their energy needs. So it was a productive conversation, and we look forward to continuing engagement with Travis and Representative Moore's office.
Okay. The lobby also took a trip to Price, Utah to meet with the mayor and a council person there. Of course, this is the heart of coal country in Utah. What kind of a reception did you get?
Oh, Leslie, I went on that trip, and it was wonderful. We were lucky enough that, I don't know if you remember, but maybe 2 or 3 years ago, our group put on a town hall for climate solutions at the Park City Library with the mayors of Park City, Heber, and Midway, two professors and a high school student. And we invited the district director for Representative Curtis to attend. She did. At the end, she said, it was really great, but you didn't really talk about a just transition for coal communities. And I said, you're right, and I'd like to. I don't know anyone in those coal communities. I want to. I've been trying to figure out how to. And, you know, just cold emailing county commissioners, and of course no one's writing me back. And so she thereafter invited us to go down to Price. They were having a rural summit organized by her from Representative John Curtis's office. And the Price mayor had just gotten a $1 million grant with the Kem Gardner Institute for their coal country strike team. And that was a team to help bring more money, energy, revitalization to coal country, including Emery County, Carbon County. So we went to that, and then we met with the mayor who worked and still works at a coal plant there, the Huntington plant, and he was so committed to trying to transition their community to other sources of revenue, you know, to really make it a thriving community. And we continued talking after that. And then he said he would be on another town hall with us. It was right after COVID hit, so it was on Zoom a little over a year ago in the spring. And then we continued talking and emailing back and forth whenever something would come up that was of interest to coal country. And so I had said to him, hey, we should come back down and maybe, you know, meet and keep talking. And he said, sure. So we finally did. And he spent his whole morning talking with us about all the challenges he's faced and all the ideas he has and things he's still doing. He just works nonstop to try to make Price a town that's not dependent on the coal plant and the coal mine. And then the next day, and he's just a really wonderful, warm guy, and really wants to, I don't know, he's just an amazing guy. So then the next day, we met with Councilwoman Terry Willis, and she took us mountain biking over around the Little Grand Canyon and wanted to show us all the, and Saturday she directed us to all the new trails they have. They have great mountain biking trails that they just put in, and I'd recommend to anyone who thinks that Moab's kind of crowded, they're looking for someplace south to go, that they check out Price and Helper and give them some tourism business and help them to continue to thrive.
Yeah. So did you get two new members of the lobby?
Well, they don't live in the Wasatch Back, so they can't be members of my chapter, unfortunately.
All right. Just a quick heads up. I've had a couple of texts telling me that the traffic there due to the accident has all been cleared up, so smooth sailing through the Kimball Junction area. Lauren, you also had a meeting with the CEO of the Park City Chamber Bureau, Jennifer Wesselhoff. I know she's preparing kind of a sustainable tourism plan. How will your organization be involved in that, if at all?
I don't know if we will be at all, but I certainly hope to continue to talk with Jennifer. I just met her for the first time, and she was also really generous with her time and wanted to learn all about what we're doing. And I wanted to talk to her about carbon fee and dividend and introducing the idea to more of the members and seeing how we can be more involved and seeing if maybe they would consider endorsing a market-based solution for climate change. And so we're going to just keep talking. And it was a great introduction.
All right. Let's see. You also plan to meet with Congressman John Curtis later this month. So do we have any action happening in the nation's capital to forward the lobby's climate goals?
Do you want to talk about that, Sebastian?
Sure. There are a couple of legislative packages in making their way through Congress in D.C. that have some forms of solutions. Currently in the budget reconciliation package that's being negotiated, several drafts included a price on carbon. So in line with the carbon fee and dividend that Citizens Climate Lobby has been pushing for as a market solution to climate change. The bipartisan infrastructure legislation that has passed the Senate and is pending in the House also includes major investments for electric vehicles, updating the electric grid, and other programs that would enable U.S. infrastructure to be in a position to handle more renewable energy and transition in a direction towards clean energy.
Okay. And then I'll give you a few minutes now to talk about Thursday's Park City Mayoral and City Council Forum. When and where is this happening?
This debate's going to be by Zoom, and it's on this Thursday, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. And if people want to register, there are a variety of ways they can. One is to go to any of our social media sites. So on Instagram, we're CCL Wasatch Back, and we're on Twitter at CCL Wasatch Back, and on Facebook, Citizens Climate Lobby Park City / Wasatch Back. And you can lobby at any of those sites, or you could email me at Citizens Climate Lobby at Wasatch Back. And we're going to invite, or we have invited, and they're going to attend the two mayoral candidates and the city council candidates. Tim Henney, Janet Tolley, and Jeremy Rubel. And Montana Barak, the rock star high school student, and I are going to moderate. We've asked for people to send us questions ahead of time, and we've started to receive some really great questions. So please email us with questions to propose or consider going on the social media and giving us questions.
Okay, so you said that email to do that is citizensclimatelobby@wasatchback.com. Is that what you said?
That's right.
Okay. So is this a single issue for you in this race? I mean, how someone stands on climate change?
Well, I'll let Sebastian talk about that, but I think it's really is for them to talk about climate solutions.
Yeah, thank you, Lauren. I think the focus is on climate solutions, and some people might see it as a single issue, but it's an issue that will impact everything from the tourism industry, you know, how winters are here in Park City, to the quality of the air we breathe, the risks of wildfires. Climate change is something that impacts every part of our community and economy, and so it's an important issue, and the solutions that are proposed at the local level have far-reaching impacts across a much broader range of issues. So it's very important to hear what candidates are proposing in terms of their policies and plans for the city, and for voters to get an idea of what those proposals are, who's more serious, who's thinking about policies that make sense for Park City to both mitigate emissions and adapt to future climate change.
So what are some of the things that Park City has done already that impresses the climate lobby?
Lauren, do you want to take that?
Sure. And also, Leslie, I gave you the wrong email address. I have it reversed. It's wasatchback@citizensclimatelobby.org or .com. Either will work.
Okay, so wasatchback@citizensclimatelobby.org. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of the things the city has done so far to address climate change? Is that what you said?
Yeah, or I guess that impresses, you know, you folks.
Oh, they've done so much, really. You know, it's really, they really stand out in a red state. But both Park City and Summit County have endorsed carbon fee and dividend solution for climate change, passed resolutions. And then Park City has, I think, was the catalyst for getting legislation passed to create renewable energy for communities around Neuchon. I think when they did that, they thought it would be just for Park City, Summit County, maybe a few ski areas, and many cities and counties have signed up to learn more and put some money into getting, transitioning to 100% renewable energy. And I think it's going to, when it's all said and done, it'll transition the economy or the power of Utah to be, I think, 23%, around 23% of the citizens will be on renewable energy, which is pretty impressive. And then they did the Mountain Towns 2030 Summit, where they brought in mountain towns from around the country to talk about climate solutions. And I think the city government's really done a lot just the last 4 years.
Yeah. Anywhere you think that the city has kind of fallen short and needs improvement?
I don't know. Do you have can you think of anything, Sebastian?
I don't know about falling short, and I'm a relatively recent transplant to the area. So I don't have enough knowledge. But I do know that there's a debate going on now about future developments and how there's potential for new construction and new projects in the area. And I think it's important for the city and county to consider, are those investments that will be in place for a while in the future set up to succeed? Do they have the infrastructure for, if it's a parking lot, charging stations for a fleet that might be 50% or 70% electric down the line? And so I think it's just important for the town to continue thinking what is both the climate going to look like in the future and the economy, the transportation fleet, and prepare for that proactively.
Okay. Hey.
Yeah, I'd like to see a business plan, you know, essentially for this is what we want our town, our city to look like, and here's how we're going to get there. And I hope the candidates have some ideas like that.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Lauren, Sebastian, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having us, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Again, if you do have questions for that upcoming mayoral and city council forum on Thursday, you can email wasatchback@citizensclimatelobby.org. Well, the Park City Board of Realtors is hosting a conversation on affordable housing this week. In the studio with details, I have the CEO of the Park City Board of Realtors, Jamie Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so when and where is this happening?
So this will be tomorrow at 10 a.m. We're offering just a coffee and a conversation at the Park City Library in the community room upstairs. And that's 1255 Park Avenue, for those who may not know. But we are working to try to have conversations within the community about this issue that is perplexing to so many, and that we are constantly, and with the election right now, there's so much talk about it, and the community has continued to attempt to have efforts that impact this issue. And maybe some don't believe that there there is a movement of anything happening. So we just want to hear conversations. We want to hear from individuals who may have ideas, people who maybe have moved here from other communities that have seen successful affordable housing options. We would like to hear from those people who live in the community that maybe don't agree that it should be in our community, that it maybe should be from outside. So we just, it's really truly just a conversation. We want to allow an opportunity for the community just to sit down together and see what can come of it.
Yeah. So who is this for, though? I mean, most people needing affordable housing, I'm guessing, are working at 10 in the morning, or perhaps you're looking at the service industry, or?
No, this, I would say, is more for the local community that maybe the ones that show up to the council meetings that are passionate about it. Maybe the individuals who live here, or have retired here, have, you know, made their mark to be able to be here and to have that Park City lifestyle. So not necessarily, you know, we did affordable housing forum or expo a couple months ago where we did invite those who were in need of affordable housing. But this is, I would say, more so for the community at large and to hear from individuals that may have opinions on the topic.
All right. And again, who's kind of leading this conversation?
So right now, this is the Park City Board of Realtors. We will have municipal leaders and government officials that will be there, I believe, that will attend. But I think it's for them, it's more of just an observation. It's just, hey, we want to hear what the community has to say about this. So I would think that some of the candidates that are running for office will be there. I think they want to hear from the community as well. So it's just kind of outside that council or, you know, the official meeting places where people come to give their opinions typically on these topics. It's just an unofficial sit down, let's have a conversation.
Yeah, and you mentioned a committee. Is that, does the board have some kind of affordable housing committee?
We are in the process. In the past years, there was an affordable housing committee, and that went away for quite a few years, and it was kind of under the umbrella of our legislative committee. So our legislative committee would stay on top of issues and developments that were coming into the Wasatch Back. And now we are, for 2022, starting to have another affordable housing committee because we do have so many members that are passionate about it.
Yeah. So what can the Board of Realtors, though, do about affordable housing? I mean, you know, you'd think Realtors basically want property values to stay high. That's where they make the commission, right?
Well, but they also believe in our community, and they want to see people that can live here and work here and play here as well, that are assets to our community and that add to the value of the lifestyle of those who come for those multi-million dollar homes. So yes, it's not necessarily that we can do anything major, but I think the education of the issues and the partnerships with our municipalities and with our developers, helping to be that bridge between some of those entities, could be where the Board of Realtors can have some input. And I think our lobbying power, both in the city, the county, and at the state and national level, is one of the things that we pride ourselves in, that we really truly want to be about home ownership and property values and helping our communities. So we are constantly working on all those three levels to assist in that.
Yeah, I mean, are you really seeing something like that? I mean, we hear about it nationwide in terms of just homes, just it's just out of reach for many people, home ownership.
Yeah, it's definitely a national issue. It's not just here in Park City. It's the majority of communities across the country. We're seeing, you know, inflation at epic levels and wondering when that's going to come down and if it's going to come down. And obviously in our markets, we've never had any huge drops. We've never had any huge dips like the rest of the country has. So I think it's something that we have to address for individuals who live in our community, because the market itself is not going to correct that.
Yeah. And in terms of kind of the work that this legislative committee does on, I mean, anything that they're working on actively to move this forward?
Again, you know, we started in the beginning of 2021 with these initiatives and reaching out and developing the relationships with the municipalities, with the council members, with the mayors, and all of the Wasatch Pack, and starting the conversations and asking how we can help. And in that time frame, we've had a few of those city managers or mayors and council people come to us about issues that may be happening not only locally but also at the state level. And so we have, right now we're working on some issues pertaining to inclusionary zoning for our state. that have some pushback from the state about being able to allow developers and cities to come up with issues when it comes to inclusionary zoning. So there are things that we are working on, but I would say it's just a constant process. It's not a, there's not going to be a quick fix to this.
Yeah, what is inclusionary zoning?
So inclusionary zoning would be if a developer is coming into the area and has a plan, that the city can require a certain amount of that development to be affordable. There are a lot of developments across the state where I guess other communities are not as passionate about that as we are, because we know it's a huge issue here.
Yeah, well, we're already doing it.
Correct, we are, but that's the thing, is the state is looking at maybe excluding that as an option for us.
Ah, so maybe, what are the rules today for buying property? Do people still need a 20% down payment in order to avoid that mortgage insurance?
You know, honestly, I would say there are programs out there for affordable units and for individuals that are at lower income levels that they would not need that. I'm not an expert on mortgage or lending, but I know that we do have multiple partners within our area and affiliate members of ours that would be more than happy to help individuals with those kind of questions.
Okay. And then when we look at how just how expensive is housing, do you have that off the top of your head, our median?
Off the top of my head, not at this very exact moment. I would say in the last 12 months, we did reach probably levels of a median income, a median sale price of about $3 million in the Park City proper area. I would say in the Wasatch back, it was probably closer to 1.7 for median. So it's definitely up there. We will have our statistics forum in a couple of weeks that will wrap up the third quarter and to kind of hear more so about where those exact numbers are right now. Obviously, inventory has impacted this quarter quite a bit.
Okay. Again, people are invited to show up at the Park City Library Community Room. That's on the third floor tomorrow at 10. Again, a conversation on affordable housing.
Yes. Thank you so much, Leslie. And we hope to see many community members join us tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you, Jamie.
Organization and proud
support. Well, a new Utah group has been working since the pandemic to bring aid, supplies, and longer-term improvements to the Navajo Reservation in Utah's southeastern corner. KPCW's Michelle Deininger checks in on their work and what Indigenous Peoples Day means to them.
During the COVID shutdown, Parkite Milani Glassman had time on her hands and was feeling useless. She heard about conditions on the Navajo Reservation in southern Utah and was horrified. The health disparities she learned of, along with living conditions far different than most Americans enjoy, struck her. Those problems are far from new, but she said the pandemic highlighted them.
A lot of the promises from the U.S. government historically haven't followed through. I mean, dating back centuries. So they kind of have been left on their own, and that's created way more health disparities, from addiction, alcoholism, to obesity, to heart disease, to diabetes. Like half the reservation is pre-diabetic. So when COVID-19 hit, I think it just highlighted everything that was already happening on the reservation, and for better or for worse, allowed others to become more aware of the conditions.
Wanting to help ease the suffering caused in part by lack of access to goods and services, she started collecting supplies for what she called urgent relief. Then she started renting a truck and driving 5 hours down to the reservation to donate regularly. She took food and dry goods, sanitation and hygiene supplies, and other essentials. Through that spontaneous gesture, she connected with Bud Frazier, who was doing the same thing. He had founded the nonprofit Navajo Strong during the pandemic and is its executive director. Frazier is a Navajo American who grew up in American Fork and now lives in Saratoga Springs. Frazier and Glassman work together now, with Glassman joining Navajo Strong as community support and outreach coordinator. Frazier told KPCW that as the pandemic has evolved, so has Navajo Strong's work. At the pandemic's height, Navajo Strong had a warehouse in Blanding to hold all the donations they were distributing and an employee to divvy up supplies, fill requests, and deliver them with volunteers' help around the reservation, where many people don't have addresses. Frazier said he gained as much as he gave during that period.
Really given me an insight and taught me a lot about my culture and how strong and resilient the Navajo people are. we're still here. We're strong and resilient, and the Navajo people adapt and have adapted. And also, you know, the culture is more of a community culture down there. It's not a every man for himself. It's helping others and supporting the community as a whole.
Glassman said the Navajo on the reservation are about 94% vaccinated now. Many elements of pre-pandemic life have returned to normal. But pressing needs remain, as do goals for improving health, quality of life, and opportunity. The reservation has just 13 grocery stores to serve a geographical area the size of West Virginia. Most people on the reservation drive several hours each way to go to the store. They're also seriously underserved by medical facilities. It may be isolated and geographically dispersed, but the reservation is highly populated. 200,000 Navajos live there, about half of all Navajo in the country's tribal nation. Navajos make up the largest indigenous community in the U.S. Now that the pandemic's most pressing needs have been met, Navajo Strong is focusing on longer-term projects that support sustainability on the reservation, such as teaching farming and harvesting practices that also preserve cultural traditions. And because the needs are complex, infrastructure to expand electricity, for example, Navajo Strong is working first and foremost on raising awareness of conditions. Glassman highlighted one among many statistics that tell the story. The New Mexico region of the reservation contains 75% of all Americans who live without running water and electricity. Frazier hopes Indigenous Peoples Day will provide people an opportunity to think about the Navajo. For him, it's also a day to celebrate family and culture.
I'm really grateful that it's not Columbus Day, that it's Indigenous Peoples Day, and that it's just bringing awareness to what's that we're still here and that there was land and culture before Columbus came. And so I just love that it's bringing awareness to Indigenous people. I plan on putting a lot of stuff on social media, probably giving my parents a call and then reaching out to other relatives just to check in.
Navajo Strong will also soon launch its second holiday toy drive, and drop boxes will be placed in Park City. Last year's drive delivered 1,100 new toys to children of all ages on the reservation. You can visit NavajoStrong.org for information on how to get involved or participate in the toy drive. Michelle Deininger, KPCW News.
The founder of the CEO of the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McNulty. Good morning, Abby.
Hi, Leslie. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks. So that seems to be a trend, directors of nonprofits now identifying as CEOs. When did you make the change?
I was granted the change this summer by the board of directors.
Okay, and why is it headed that way?
I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know why in general, but in my case, I think it reflects just the growth in the position. I've been here for a long time, and the growth and responsibilities and the depth and breadth of the work that I do on a daily basis.
Okay. So you do serve as an employee of the Park City School District?
That's correct, yeah.
All right. So you receive... Go ahead.
The Ed Foundation, all of our staff are employees of the Park City School District. That was a designation many years ago by the actual Utah legislature, which wanted stronger oversight of education foundations throughout the state. And so we made the change. Gosh, it's probably been 10 years now. And we reimburse the school district for the costs of our employees.
Okay. So you do receive the school district health benefits. What about a state pension? Do you receive that as well?
Yes, that's right. So we are technically employees of Park City School District as required, and so we receive all the benefits and then reimburse the school district for all those costs.
Okay. I saw a bunch of signs go up over the weekend for the Friends of Park City Education to vote yes on the school bond. Is this work by the Ed Foundation?
No, it's not. And that is a separate group. I believe it's called Friends of the Bond Group. And as you know, the Park City School District cannot advocate for or against their own bond, and Park City's Education Foundation employees are included in that. So we don't take a stand one way or the other, except on our own personal time after 6 o'clock and on the weekends. We can advocate how we feel personally about that, the bond.
Okay, so can you tell me who this group is?
I don't know, Leslie. You would have to, I don't know who the group is personally, but I'd be happy to make that, find out for you and send an email introduction.
Okay.
Once I have the information.
Okay. I mean, I've gone online and I just don't see, there's just no names. So
is there a contact? Is there a way to contact on the website? Perhaps that's the best way to reach out.
Yeah, you can fill out a form, right?
They'll
get back to you, but they don't tell us who they are. So, okay.
Okay.
Let's see. You also have just wrapped up the Red Gala. How did that go?
It was great. So as you may remember, we had to cancel the gala last year because of COVID precautions. And so we skipped a year not having the Red Apple. We were able to host it this past October 2nd at Montage Deer Valley, and it's sponsored by Zions Bank, and it was amazing. We had 300 really excited education advocates in the room, all very happy to be supporting the Ed Foundation and our schools, and very happy to be back together celebrating what a great year we've had last year. And it was a wonderful event. We brought the community together in a way, as one person mentioned, it's clear that our community is very hungry to support our schools.
Yeah. How much were you able to raise?
We raised just shy of $700,000.
Wow. Is that a record?
Absolutely. Yes.
Wow. And is that just on donations, or was that just auction items, or how did that all work?
It's all of the above. It's donations at the event. It's sponsorships. It's ticket and table sales. It's Raise the Paddle. It's silent auction, live auction. It's the entire event. All together. And for sure, that's a record for us. And again, I think it's just this, our community is really hungry to support our schools, and how the Ed Foundation supports our schools. As we all know, Utah is the lowest funded education system in the country. And when you make donations to the Ed Foundation, all donations stay here in our community to support our schools. We support over 100 programs in our schools every year. At least $1.3 million goes back into our schools to support really valuable programs that our kids love and want, and our teachers find great support from grants that come from the Ed Foundation.
Yeah, so give us a comparison. What was the high amount prior to the almost $700,000?
Yeah, so 2 years ago, the last time we hosted, we raised just about $500,000.
Wow, that's significant.
It is. It certainly is.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, yeah.
Are there any limits?
It surprised us too.
Are there any limits, though, on the money the foundation can raise? And the reason I ask is because I guess when the state lawmakers kind of hear this, they're going to be interested in the money.
No, there are no limits that the Ed Foundation can raise. It's a community decision. These are donor-directed dollars. The legislature has no role in deciding and how donors can make their donations, or once they make a donation, where those go. So Ed Foundations are really common in the state of Utah. In fact, they're really common throughout the country now, because education is underfunded, public education, which educates 90% of the kids in our country. And so this has become essentially a bit of a workaround when the state tax dollars are not enough. Park City Education Foundation is one of the best ed foundations in the country, and that's really because of the incredible hard work of our board, our staff, and the amazing volunteers and supporters and donors who come together to really support education locally in Park City.
Okay. Also completed another fundraiser, and this is where you reach out to your education community, parents, Beat the Call. How did things stand there?
Beat the Call was amazing. So for those who don't know, Beat the Call is our annual campaign where we ask parents to make a contribution of any amount in support of our schools and support of their kids. We really focus on participation to get as many parents jumping off the sidelines and jumping into supporting education actively in the community. We had 43% participation this year, which is really amazing and awesome to start the year off that way. As a comparison, last year at the end of the year, 45% of parents or participating in ed foundation activities. So that's great. Our first place winner, so we do a competition. The schools compete for a cash grant that they then use at their school site for whatever the greatest need is at their school. And that cash grant is sponsored by the UPS store, Park City. And the first place winner was Jeremy Ranch. They had an astounding 84% of parents participating. So that is really exciting. And then second and third place was a tie between Trailside Elementary and McPullen Elementary with 75% of parents participating. So, and then each of the other schools also got a $1,000 cash grant for participating and beat the call and helping get the word out.
Yeah. You do ask for a dollar a day, $180. What's the percentage of people who actually donate that much as opposed to maybe $20?
Yeah, that is actually a great question. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I'd be happy to come back with it next time. But we do get a variety of donation amounts during our annual Beat the Call campaign, anywhere from $5 to $180 per kid. So if you have two kids, that's $360. It's a broad range. And again, we do seek participation, not dollar amount.
Okay. All right. And finally, let's just get an after-school program update. What's going on there?
Yeah. So after-school is one of the Ed Foundation's key initiatives, and we support after-school programming in collaboration with the school district in grades K through 9. And we started funding after-school in 2007 when the Boys and Girls Club shut its doors, many, many years ago. And it fills a huge gap for families who need affordable care, and it also provides academic and homework support to kids. It also is a place for intensive reading intervention, science exploration activities, art, mindfulness, and a place where community partners all come together to support students, largely in the K to 5 program, but also at Ecker Hill and Treasure as well. It's in all four elementary schools, and I mentioned the two upper schools, and in those grades at Ecker and Treasure, it's really based on student interest and is about providing kids with a nurturing place to be after school where they can make connections with caring adults, and so that no kid falls through the cracks. That would be the worst thing for our community. So this year also, Park City Ed Foundation is funding the school district pilot initiative for before school programs at Parley's and McPullen, and which I think is a huge benefit to working families. And the last thing I will say is we are hosting a virtual site visit today at 10 a.m. of our after school programs. It will just be a quick check in with one of our principals and the after school program lead of all after school programs in the district. And just a great way to learn a little bit more. If anyone's interested, they can email me directly and I will share the Zoom link. It's my email address is amcnulty@pcschools.us.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just thank you to the community for continuing to show support for schools and students. And we are so grateful to have the role that we do of helping enrich the classrooms every day.
Abby, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a great day.
Well, a new sales tax will be on November ballots for Wasatch County voters. With about a month until the election, Heber City, Midway, and the county are coming to an agreement for sharing revenue. The RAP tax is a local sales tax that would generate money that Heber City, Midway, and Wasatch County could use for recreation, arts, and parks. It will only go into effect if Wasatch County voters vote in favor of it on the November 2nd municipal election. The new tax would add 0.1% to the current sales tax rate for the next 10 years. It would apply to all shopping except most groceries. The county estimates that it would generate some $800,000 in its first year and more in the years to come. It also estimates as much as half of that would be from visitors to the county. Councilwoman Rachel Kaler raised the point that even with the election less than a month away, many local voters may not know much about the RAP tax.
We have not got ahead of the public by really introducing what the RAB tax will do, how that money will be spent. And I still don't think we have very good answers from a countywide perspective. I mean, from the city, I think we have a good plan moving forward. But I'm really fearful that this first pass at trying to pass the RAB tax will leave more questions than answers.
The city has outlined a parks master plan, which is on the website for its general plan, envisionheber.com. As described in the Heber City Parks Master Plan, the estimated $800,000 would be for new trails, parks, and arts programs, as well as improvements to existing facilities. The plan says that there is space in future development plans for 7 new parks or expansions of 45 total acres. The city's goal is to develop at least 19 of those acres into functioning parks by 2030. Another push is to fill gaps in the current trail system.